Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Today is an unusual mixture. It is both the fourth Sunday of Advent and Christmas Eve. For most of the day, we are waiting in anticipation of the birth of Jesus. In the evening, we are singing Gloria in Excelsis Deo with the angels as we recall their greeting to the shepherds as they watched their sheep on the hillsides around Bethlehem. There is a very real sense of both not yet and of accomplishment. So, as I prepared this programme, it is with the amazing realisation that some of our listeners will be celebrating Christmas while others are still waiting, are still within the season of Advent. Part of me wants to say, He is coming soon, whilst part of me is wishing each and every one of you a very happy and holy Christmas with every possible grace and blessing. In today's programme, Joan Lewis and I, Sister Janet Ferns, look back at the Vatican's week and forwards to Christmas. Let it be done to me according to your word. Listen to what Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett have to say about the incredible words of Mary, the words that made way for Christmas.
Mary set out, proceeding in haste into the hill country to a town of Judah, where she entered Zechariah's house and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby stirred in her womb. Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit and cried out in a loud voice, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. But who am I, that the mother of my Lord should come to me? The moment your greeting sounded in my ears, the baby stirred in my womb for joy. Blessed is she who trusted that the Lord's words to her would be fulfilled."
With Christmas only a few days away, the liturgy of this last Sunday of Advent takes a leap back in time of some 30 years, to those early days in the history of our salvation, when the greatest story ever told had only just begun. The scene is no longer the desert or the banks of the Jordan, but has shifted, and is now a rough stony track, along which a donkey is proceeding at a comfortable donkey pace. His passenger, a young girl of perhaps 13 or 14, may not be so comfortable and is probably somewhat impatient, as the young tend to be. From Nazareth to Ain Karim was a caravan journey of 4 or 5 days, and Mary, for she is our protagonist, must surely have asked other travellers, "Are we nearly there?" as children do. We're not told if Mary went alone or in company. What we do know is that she had no hesitation about making such a long journey. Mary set out at that time and went as quickly as she could to a town in the hill country of Judah. In haste, we read in today's and other versions. But in however much of a hurry you were in those days, you had to adapt to the speed and temper of your mount. And then there were the roads, or rather tracks. The terrain was not exactly smooth. The gospel is explicit. It was hill country. But let's hear how modern writer Ettore Masina imagines that journey.
Ain Karim is at the top of a mountain. The road is steep. When travellers reach it after a long journey, they get down from their mounts to give the animals a bit of a break. An inexplicable haste strains at the heart of Mary of Nazareth. With the unconscious cruelty of the young, she digs her heels into the flanks of the donkey which is carrying her. Now and then, she catches a whiff of the scent of juniper and oregano, but she's hardly aware of it. It's 150 kilometres from Nazareth to Ain Karim, along sandy or sharp, stony tracks. What a long way for the young girl who wants to know if it is true or just an illusion that something is moving in her womb, just very slightly, like the flutter of a butterfly's wing. The angel had told her, "With God nothing is impossible. Do you want a proof? Your cousin Elizabeth, who is old now, is in the 6th month of her pregnancy."
The graceful village of Ain Karim lies not far from Jerusalem among brown hills planted with vines and olives, writes a traveller of our time, and the guidebook offers more detail.
A picturesque village west of Jerusalem, nestled in a deep valley surrounded by high, steep mountains and adorned with many olive and cypress trees. In its centre is a sweet water spring, Ain, used since time immemorial to water the gardens and vineyards, the Karim of the village.
The guidebook goes on to tell us that it was identified back in the Byzantine period as the city of Judah, mentioned in Luke as the native town of John the Baptist. In the Middle Ages, the village was known as St. John in the Mountains. And in another guidebook we read that in the time of Jesus, Ain Karim was a part of the Roman administrative district called the District of the Mountain. What can Mary's feelings have been when she sighted that little village on the top of its mountain? Had she ever been there before? It doesn't seem too likely. Elizabeth was clearly not a first cousin given her age, but they knew of each other, and maybe they'd met at the temple in Jerusalem. Who knows? Since the visit of the angel at the Annunciation, Mary has had to keep her secret to herself. She would certainly not have confided in any stranger during that long journey from her home in Nazareth. Were her thoughts rather like these of the poet Yeats? He had been looking at Byzantine mosaic pictures of the Annunciation, and these, he noted, show a line drawn from a star to the ear of the Virgin. She received the word through the ear. A star fell and a star was born. This explanation helps to understand the opening lines of the poem, The Mother of God.
The threefold terror of love. A fallen flare through the hollow of an ear. Wings beating about the room. The terror of all terrors that I bore the heavens in my womb. Had I not found content among the shows every common woman knows, chimney corner, garden walk, or rocky cistern where we tread the clothes and gather all the talk? What is this flesh I purchased with my pains, this fallen star my milk sustains, this love that makes my heart's blood stop or strikes a sudden chill into my bones and bids my hair stand up?
Elizabeth Jennings, also writing of Mary's feelings after the Annunciation, comments that she can take comfort from the things she knows, though in her heart new loving burns. Alone to all men's eyes I now must go, and by myself must live with a strange child that is my own. But she concludes, it is a human child she loves, though a god stirs beneath her breast, and great salvations grip her side. And thirdly, the meditation of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta on this gospel.
Mary, God's most beautiful gift to the human race. The moment Jesus came into her life, she was full of grace, and immediately she went with haste to give him to others, the fruit of her oneness with Christ, the fruit of her prayer, the fruit of her total surrender to God, by saying, "Behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be done to me according to your word." The fruit of her oneness with God's will was her longing and desire to give him to others. So she went with haste to do this, the humble work of a handmaid. And that is just what God expects from you and from me. When we eat the bread of life, we too are full of God, full of Jesus. Do we really take him with haste to others? The people with whom we come into contact in our home, in the place where we work, can they really see Jesus in us? Does the light of Jesus shine in us and through us to others? It should, because the same Jesus who came into Mary's womb comes to us in Holy Communion. And we too, like her, must go with haste to give him to others.
On that historic occasion, when Mary came at last over the brow of the hill and into the village of Ain Karim, was she expected? From Luke's Gospel, it does not seem so, for he simply writes that she entered Zechariah's house and greeted Elizabeth. And on hearing Mary's greeting, we read, "The baby stirred in her womb," more familiarly, "leapt for joy." But Luke, as we've been told, is recounting what Mary has told him. And so the event is seen from her point of view and what she remembers. But Ettore Masina, with a certain amount of poetic license, presents the scene differently and writes that Elizabeth was waiting for her young cousin.
Elizabeth means fullness, and until 6 months ago, that name had taken on the character of a trick of fate, for Elizabeth was empty. Her womb like an uninhabited cave, her house devoid of children. And now, suddenly, when the time for childbearing is long past, has come the grace. The servant sent to meet Mary points her out in the distance. There she is. Then Elizabeth goes out of the house and waits for her by a spring. They look at each other, the old one and the young girl. And immediately Elizabeth, with the intuition some pregnant women have, senses that Mary too is expecting a child, and that God, who has freed her from the shame of sterility, is accomplishing an even greater marvel. The child leaps for joy in her womb, and the words come from her lips as if someone has prompted her, "Blessed are you among women, and you, who will give birth to my Lord, have come to visit me. My babe, on hearing your voice, exults in my womb. Blessed are you who believed in the word of the Lord."
In a homily on the Annunciation, Gregory of Nyssa, writing in the 4th century, ended with this reflection on Elizabeth's words to Mary.
"Blessed are you among women, for you have been placed above all virgins, for you have been found worthy to give shelter to the Lord, for you have received within you the one who is so great that nothing in the world could him contain. You have received him who fills all with himself, for you have become the place in which has come to pass salvation. For you have been the vehicle that has ushered in the King to life. For you have appeared as a treasure, a spiritual pearl. Blessed are you among women."
And returning to our present-day writer, we find this comment.
"Only women, I think, can understand what happened that day. Perhaps it was then, near a spring, that Mary felt happy, as she'd never felt before, or as she did many years later, on the day of the resurrection. Perhaps the joy of having someone near her with whom she could share her secret, a person full of faith in the mystery which was taking place in her womb, brought her to an understanding which she had not yet had. She felt She was swimming in the clear river of the history of the covenant between God and his people. She felt that from her all the scriptures were about to bring forth fruit. Page after page of the history of Israel flashed through her mind. She said, or perhaps she sang, those words, rephrased in a new fabric, new as the flesh of her child. It was a song of glory to God, the song which from that time on tells all the poor that God is on their side. My soul magnifies the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God my Saviour. The Lord has done great things. He has put down the mighty from their seats and has exalted the humiliated ones. Meanwhile, Elizabeth listened and wept. The axe and the cross were still far off. The story of John the Forerunner and of Jesus the Saviour began in joy.
This is one man's interpretation of the visitation. Of some of the details, the meeting by a spring, the servant watching for Mary's arrival, I would not be too sure. The event is somehow too great, too close and intimate to be lived out in public. Curiously enough, a fountain or spring also figures in the traditional accounts of the Annunciation, writes the guidebook.
Tradition tells us that by the fountain the angel Gabriel first appeared to Mary while she was drawing water. From here, Mary went to her home where the Annunciation took place.
Carlo Carretto imagines Mary telling him how Elizabeth reacted to Mary's greeting.
She started singing for joy, and I sang with her. We seemed mad, the two of us, but mad with love. And there was a third one who seemed mad with joy. It was the little one, the future John, who danced in Elizabeth's womb as if to celebrate Jesus who was in mine. They were unforgettable days.
Unforgettable days indeed they must have been. And let's leave Mary and Elizabeth there singing for joy and love and praising God. And to close, here's an extract from the journal of the American Trappist monk Thomas Merton, written on the Feast of the Visitation, 1948, July the 2nd, as it was in those days.
Last evening, on the vigil of the feast, we had an unusually long interval after collation. It was a fast day, and so we weren't long in refectory in the evening and got out early. Since the sun was higher than it usually is in that interval, I saw the country in a light that we usually do not see. The low slanting rays picked out the foliage of the trees and highlighted a new wheat field against the dark curtain of woods on the knobs that were in shadow. It was very beautiful. Deep peace. Sheep on the slopes behind the sheep barn, the new trellises in the novitiate garden leaning and sagging under a hill of roses, a cardinal singing suddenly in the walnut tree, and piles of fragrant logs all around the woodshed waiting to be cut in bad weather. I looked at all this in great tranquillity, with my soul and spirit quiet. For me, landscape seems to be important for contemplation.
Incidentally, the cardinal mentioned in the diary is, of course, the popular American bird with the brilliant red plumage and a repertoire of at least 28 different songs. And talking of songs, does anyone remember that lovely Advent hymn we used to sing? I've tried to find a recorded version, but with no success. But here are the words. Like the dawning of the morning on the mountain's golden heights, like the breaking of the moonbeams in the gloom of cloudy nights, like a secret told by angels getting known upon the earth, is the mother's expectation of Messiah's speedy birth.
And now Joan Lewis and I look back at the Vatican's week and forwards to Christmas. Well, Joan, when people listen to this programme, just think, some of our listeners will be still in Advent and others will be celebrating Christmas.
Well, depending exactly wherever you are in the world. And if you're in Rome, it's actually very possible that you are with family, so you're not hearing these words. Actually, that would be a lovely thought for me personally to think that a lot of our listeners are with family, or of course they're getting ready to go to the Pope's midnight mass. And oh, you know, that was one of the big stories this week in, not big stories, but I mean certainly for the Vatican. The news came out several days ago. It's actually old in a way. Every single one of the 8,000 tickets that were available for the Pope's Mass is gone. All of the possible places are reserved. And I had first heard about this at the North American College, because they distribute tickets for this at the Casa Santa Maria. And Monsignor Wrench said they're just getting so frustrated because they're getting letters from big, important people and small, you know, just individuals asking for tickets, and they don't have any. It's like people aren't believing them. And, of course, there's no wait list, you know, so if Joan doesn't show up, you can get on the list. But it's a sellout, even though obviously the tickets are free, but it's a huge popular success. But, you know, when you consider the crowds that come on Wednesday for the audience, on Sunday for the Angelus.
Because at the moment it's an average of 50,000.
Sure. And I mean, to only have 8,000 in St. Peter's Basilica, which that's what it can take. That's a very small number, obviously, of the requests. So,
but we know in advance that there are going to be a lot of people actually in St. Peter's Square watching the Mass through those massive screens as well.
That's the one thing I was trying to find out. I wasn't sure if they were going to have the screens or not, because, you know, when you start Mass that late, it's already been dark for a couple of hours. The temperature has gone down. You're going to have to be really, really bundled up. And but, you know, if people want to do that, that's fine. And, of course, a lot of people will be going, as is the custom here in Italy, they'll be going to their own parishes for midnight Mass. So you have the family dinner. Following that, you go to midnight Mass. And the streets are pretty full about 2 o'clock when Mass is getting out and everything. It's quite amazing.
But the square itself will be worth seeing, because the Christmas tree this year is fantastic.
It's beautiful.
And just the little bit you can see of the top of the crib, which is only going to be shown to public view on Christmas Eve, looks as if it's going to be really spectacular.
Well, I was at the tree lighting ceremony, and it's always beautiful. I've attended for a number of years, and it's fun to see the people from the region who have donated the tree this year. It's Calabria, and it's supposed to be the highest tree that was ever in St. Peter's Square. I think it actually lost a couple of feet. They had to cut some off at the bottom to get it in the stand. So it may not, if you want to measure up to the top today, be the tallest, but who cares? It is gorgeous. And the lights on it were spectacular. What a beautiful job the men did of putting the lights up. So you have the tree donated by the Calabria region, and there were officials from there and folklore dancers and singers. And it's a fun ceremony. It really, really is. And it was a young child, I think 10 years old, who actually pushed the button that lit the tree. And like you said about the crib, too, that right now is, of course, covered completely on the sides by very, very thick canvas or some material so that we can't see in. It will be revealed on the 24th, and then the little statue of the baby Jesus that will be in St. Peter's at the midnight Mass will be, my understanding, brought out and put in after the Mass.
And what I like about the Italian cribs, I think they're a real art form. But they try to situate the birth of Christ within society. So you don't just have Jesus, Mary and Joseph and the shepherds and the kings. You have a whole
village.
Street scene,
sure.
Town, village.
And you might have 100 characters.
A parish that I used to live in many years ago, the Italian parish, because I go to Santa Susanna, the American parish, but this Italian parish had one made by firemen who lived in the area. It was gorgeous. And like you said, it was like a miniature of any time we've ever seen Nazareth or Bethlehem or something else in a movie. Just reduce that to, you know, a 1 to 100 scale or something. Beautiful buildings, the lights that look like flickering flames, the little wells, some of which actually work and have, you know, water that's recycled, and the people going about their business of baking breads and shoeing horses, and they're very, very beautiful scenes. But I understand the one in St. Peter's Square this year, it's going to be 400 square meters.
It's going to be the biggest ever.
That they've ever had, and actually the first one was like a fifth of this size. The very first one put up, John Paul asked that there be a tree and a crib in St. Peter's Square for him to see from his window, and surely he had something in his apartment, but he wanted people to associate, to be able to come to St. Peter's and see this. And so every single year it has been a different design done within the Vatican, and this year they have had help on this from the northern region of Italy, from Trentino. And there's going to have, instead of the usual 17 figures, some of which, I think 9 of which, date to 1842 and are in Sant'Andrea della Valle. In addition to those 17 figures, there are 13 other new figures. And you're going to have the usual, the shepherds, but you're going to have a bagpiper and just people added, regular you and me and everybody else people that are added to the scene.
And just before we actually finish the program, one of the things that I do like about Christmas in Rome is the way in which so many people have it as their custom to go along to St. Peter's on Christmas morning to wish the Pope a happy Christmas.
Yes. No, it's absolutely wonderful to come to this square on Christmas Day, on Sundays.
The atmosphere is fabulous.
It really, really is.
And we finish our program today with wishing all our listeners a very, very happy Christmas for themselves and for all those whom they love.
And a blessed, wonderful, healthy New Year.
Definitely. On behalf of all of us at the English Programme of Vatican Radio, may I wish you and all those whom you love a very happy and holy Christmas, filled with every grace and blessing. You have been listening to Jill Bevilacqua, Sean Patrick Lovett, Joan Lewis, and to me, Sister Janet Ferns. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or by going online to the main Vatican Radio website at vaticanradio.org. Click on English and there we are. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.